executive session. As you can see, we have great participation from our proponents and opponents of these bills, but meager participation from the committee members. It's my belief that all the committee members that are not here are testifying on bills in other hearings and will be here shortly. What I'd like to do is just stand at ease till about 9:15, and we'll see if we can fill up the bench up here, and then we'll have to we'll try to proceed. If anybody has a time problem, we'd like to testify now to give you that opportunity. Otherwise, we're going to have to back it up a few minutes. As you might note from the agenda today, we are scheduled to do these four bills in the morning. I still think we can get through by 10:30 or 11, but at that time we'll have to go to session, and there will be no afternoon session of this committee, so we're going to have to watch pretty carefully our time. So with that, we'll stand at ease for about 10 more minutes and see if we draw any more committee members. If we don't, then we're going to have to proceed, and you'll have to talk to me and Representative McPherson. Good morning. Okay, so we'll just stand at ease for a few minutes then and see if we can gather a few more folks. Anderson first, because he is, I believe, the chief sponsor of these four bills, or most of them. Representative, good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, I'm Representative Gordon Anderson from District 3, Josephine County. Thank you for hearing these bills, and today I'm appearing before you because I believe these bills will go a long way in helping to stabilize the medical malpractice insurance market in Oregon. These are not traditional tort reform bills, as you've heard over the last several days. Instead, they're bills that bring back common sense to the medical liability insurance market by improving conditions so more medical liability insurers will come to our state and offer their services. As you know, Oregon remains a crisis state, according to the American Medical Association. When new doctors are looking for a place to set up their practice, they don't want to locate in states that are adverse to doctors. Given the current state of affairs, the business climate for medical malpractice insurers must improve, and with these bills, the legislature can make this happen. There are only two companies that insure the majority of Oregon physicians. The hospital medical malpractice insurance market continues to be a problem. The two largest insurers of Oregon hospitals, St. Paul and Farmers, have withdrawn from the medical malpractice insurance market. There remains only one primary company willing to consider insuring hospitals. Additional insurance companies will not enter the state due to the negative litigation environment. Premiums have increased from 100% to over 300% for doctors and hospitals. Unless conditions improve in Oregon in the near future, first, healthcare providers will continue to alter or leave their present practices, particularly those doing obstetrics, trauma, and neurosurgery. Second, Oregon Medical School students will continue to locate in other states after graduation, and Oregon will continue to experience difficulty in recruiting new healthcare providers to the state. These bills will increase availability and affordability of liability insurance for healthcare providers and hospitals. Please let me now introduce Dr. Bill Gallagher, who will share with you a brief history of the locally owned Northwest Physicians Mutual Insurance Company. And with your permission, I'd like to excuse myself to Human Services Committee.
Thank you, Representative, and let me make just a couple of remarks. First, I neglected to open the public hearing on House Bill 2893, and I will do that at this time. Since I'm a majority and a minority of one of the subcommittee, I'll suspend the rules and provide that your testimony previously given will be considered as a part of the public hearing and part of the public record. And with that, I'll ask if there's any questions from the members of at this time, committee members, non-committee members. All right. Thank you for your overview,
you.
Representative.
Thank you.
Chairman Ackerman and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Bill Gallagher. I'm an orthopedic surgeon. I've practiced here in Salem for nearly 30 years now. I also am president and chairman of Northwest Physicians Mutual Insurance Company. I want to give you a very brief picture of who we are. Northwest Physicians Mutual is an Oregon company. It was started in 1983 by 12 doctors in Salem. It is a mutual company, and that means, as you all know, that all policyholders are owners of the company. NPM, as we are known, insures about half of the doctors in the state, and we sell only medical liability insurance. Our goal at NPM is now, as it has been, that the company will stay in business no matter how rough the going. As we all know, the going has been very rough the last few years. NPM lost $30 million over 5 years. NPM has stayed in business thanks to the loyalty of its doctors, but doctors' premiums have had to rise 150 to 300%. Doctors want to own their own company in order to provide a stable source of insurance. As we all know, and as we've heard over the last couple of years, Oregon is losing medical care, and recruitment of new doctors is very difficult. The Physician Board of Directors for the company requests these four bills that are being discussed today on behalf of all Oregon doctors. We wish to thank Representative Anderson for sponsoring them. We feel that these four bills represent common sense changes. And more importantly, these bills do not limit awards, and they do not take away money from injured patients. They will, however, help stabilize the medical liability market and help to lower premiums for your physician constituents. We feel strongly that these bills will improve medical care in your communities and will provide the access to medical care that we all want and need. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and with your permission, I'd like to return later to answer questions or to give further testimony.
Fine. Any questions from the committee members? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Gallagher, I want to focus in on House Bill 2896, the pre-litigation hearing panel. I'm aware that there's a system working in some other states.
We're going one bill at a time.
I'm sorry. I thought he was presenting on the on all four of them.
Well, he's also signed up to come back.
Okay, that's fine. Why don't we hold off into that bill?
Okay.
Okay.
Further questions for the committee on this bill? Doctor, we have talked, I think, in last session about the PLF model and the resistance of your company to pool risks. Is that still your position?
Yes, it is.
Have you done any modeling of what the impact might be on insurance premiums if you did partially or fully pool all of the risks in your business?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we have. I would ask our CEO, Jim Dorgan, to testify to that.
Okay. Is he signed up here today?
Yes, he is.
Okay. Then we'll catch that later. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. I will call the next up in a series of panels so that we can try to accommodize our time. So Jim Dorgan. Looks like Ray Englander and Charlie, and I'm missing the last word, the last name. Hinkle, that's what I thought it was. I could take a chance. I probably should have. If you'd like to come forward, please. You may testify in any order you wish.
I'll start out for our group here. Representative Ackerman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Dorgan. I'm CEO of Northwest Physicians Mutual. I've been with the company since its founding in 1983, and through the years we've insured physicians in Oregon, currently insuring about 2,000 Oregon private practice physicians. As Dr. Gallagher mentioned, we're a mutual company, and that means that we are similar to what you refer to as a PLF model in that we don't have outside stockholders. We're owned by our policyholders, and our only purpose is to insure physicians in the state. The four bills that we introduced today are bills that we feel are reasonable bills that will meet a constitutional challenge and address a portion of the problem in the medical malpractice market. The bills that we're dealing with were bills that, or issues that were discussed and recommended or came out as recommendations of the governor's task force in 2002 that I participated in, and they are not the the bills or the approaches that tend to completely modify the system. They don't cap damages. They don't limit attorney fees. They just get some procedural issues that we feel will help us in continuing to insure physicians in the state. The bill that were taking them bill by bill, and you're starting with 2896?
No, I just we're going one bill at a time, so we're on 2893.
Okay. 2893, settlement offset legislation, is a problem for us in settling cases and reaching resolution. What happens in cases now is, in the event that one party settles out and the case proceeds to trial, the jury is not allowed to be aware of that settlement, and there's no offset for that settlement in the case. So what it does, in effect, is allows for a double collection in cases that are litigated. I'll give you one example where it had a very serious impact for the physician and the medical community. It was a case where a neurosurgeon and a hospital were sued after an accident where a patient came through the emergency room. The hospital settled out the case for $8 million. The physician had very minor involvement in terms of the treatment and the cause of the damages alleged in the malpractice case. But with that settlement, they then refocused the case against the neurosurgeon, and we were required to pay his $1 million policy limits to settle that case, which in effect was a double collection. If the case was, if we were allowed to introduce the fact that the patient had received $8 million and was fully compensated for the damage, we believe that the neurosurgeon could have been successfully defended without putting his personal assets at risk. As a result of this case, from this neurosurgeon, he withdrew from treating trauma and doing head surgery, cranial surgery anymore, and it was part of the reason that the trauma system for neurosurgery in his community collapsed. So we feel that this is a fairness issue, and we hear a lot about juries needing to hear the cases and hear about the cases, but what they don't hear is the settlements that take place behind the scene. We feel this will put fairness into the system for healthcare providers that are sued, and generally multiple healthcare providers are sued in the cases that we see. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, please.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Ray Englander. I am a neurologist in Eugene. I've been there for some 27 years now. And in addition, I also practice in Florence one day a week, so I get to see it from more of the rural side as well as the urban side. And I'd just like to testify in favor of 2893. Again, I think I'm going to use Mr. Dorrigan's language. From a physician standpoint, this is clearly an issue of fairness. We feel that we are can be singled out, that our individual personal assets which we accumulate over the years can be at risk, and this is all to the detriment, ultimately, of medical care in our community. Follow up, I'm not sure of what community he was speaking about, the neurosurgical case, but I do know, for example, that in Medford, Oregon, they don't have neurosurgical coverage because of this problem on, I think it's every Thursday and every other weekend. And we've had occasion at Sacred Heart in Eugene, since we're the closest trauma center now, to receive patients. I've been involved with one patient that I do know the story on. It was not trauma, but that patient had an intracerebral hemorrhage in Medford, a bleeding in the brain. That patient was not able to have surgery in Medford. They were AeroVac to Eugene, and the time between the
two sites, two CAT scans, one done in Medford, one done in Eugene. The patient's hemorrhage enlarged significantly. He died in less than 24 hours. I can't be sure he would have survived in Medford, but I do know that the two-hour travel didn't help him any. And I do know that this becomes a real problem for medical care. And so anything we can do to help stabilize the system to allow us to recruit physicians is very important. We're in my neurology group trying to recruit physicians now. And they all the potential recruits ask about the malpractice situation in Oregon. They've all heard about it. It used to be that we could get the best of the best in Oregon when we were recruiting for physicians. That's just not the case now. There are other barriers as well, but this is always one of three barriers that potential physicians to our community bring up. And I think in fairness, to everybody, having a bill like 2893 in place where one can get the money that they deserve for any injury that they sustain, I personally believe that that's fair. They should. If I screw up, they should get compensated fairly, but they shouldn't get overcompensated at my expense, and I think that this would help move in that direction. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, we'll take the questions at the end. Mr. Hinkle?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Charles Hinkle. I'm a lawyer. I've been in private practice in Portland for over 33 years, and during the better part of that time, I have specialized in constitutional law. I've taught constitutional law for many years at Lewis and Clark Law School and have been very active in the Oregon State Bar's constitutional law section. I was asked to review this set of bills this morning for their constitutionality, and I have done so. Dr. Gallagher said during his testimony that these bills do not limit awards and they do not take away any remedy. And that's the key, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that's the key to the constitutional question. There is no limitation on an award that can be given, and there is no remedy that these bills abolish. With specific reference to the first bill, 2893, the offset of settlement payments, the important thing is to remember the two bases for constitutional challenges that are usually made to any kind of bill in this area are the remedy clause of the Oregon Constitution and the jury trial clause. Well, and we look to what the law was, according to the Oregon Supreme Court, we look to what the law was in 1857. In 1857, when our Constitution was adopted, the remedy that was available to plaintiffs, to injured parties, was to achieve full compensation for their injuries. And the jury trial guarantee was a companion guarantee to that remedy clause. The jury trial remedy was guarantee was to have that you had the right to have a jury decide the amount of your damages. So the remedy clause said you get your remedy, you get full compensation. The jury trial clause says how much you get. 2893 does not affect either of those in any way. A jury will still make the determination as to how much the damages are, and the injured person will still get that full amount of money. So there is no compromise of either of those two constitutional clauses put out by House Bill 2893. I have submitted written comments, Mr. Chairman, a three-page memorandum that addresses 2893 and the other four bills, other three bills. In case I don't testify further, I just want to point out one typographical error on the top of page three. In the fourth line, there's a word nothing that should be stricken there in the middle of that line. It was from a prior draft, obviously, and didn't get caught, and I apologize for that. Third page, fourth line, the very middle of that line, the word nothing should be stricken.
Yeah. Okay, I've made that notation, Mr. Hinkle. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative McPherson.
I'll throw this out to the panel generally, and I'm not sure either Mr. Hinkle or Mr. Dorgan should respond, perhaps. But I think of comparative negligence as being an issue as between the negligence of the plaintiff and a defendant, but in a typical medical malpractice situation, there'd be no negligence on the part of the patient. But what this seems to engage is in a situation where you have, well, obviously it does, multiple potential defendants, and without this change, I understand there's no way to bring into the proceeding against one defendant the presence or involvement of another party who's not a party to the action. Am I understanding that correctly?
Under the current system, you can bring in another party and have an apportionment of liability. But what happens then in the event that there are multiple defendants, one party settles out, it then requires the other defendants to essentially put on a case against their co-defendants in order to increase to increase their percentage allocation. What this does is it allows a straight offset for the settling parties, because what happens if two people are sued and the case is directed toward both people, the plaintiff will settle out against one party, redirect the case only against the second party that remains in the case, and then it's up to the other defendant then to put on a case if they want to get a percent allocation against the settling party.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, I'm trying to absorb that, maybe follow up. So as the law stands now, it is possible then to proceed in the same action against a third party who is not a party at that point because they have been settled as with the plaintiff, but they could the example you gave where the hospital had settled and the physician had not, if the physician went to trial, the physician could bring the hospital in as a third-party defendant and establish their proportion of the liability. Am I understanding that right?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Hearing none, we thank you for your testimony, and I'll call up the next panel, which is the remaining witnesses on this bill, Mike Krull, Bill Syme, and Robert Neuberger. The first two are proponents of the bill. The last witness is an opponent of the bill. I'd like to have the proponents go first. Go ahead. I want the proponents first, that's all.
Pardon?
I just want the proponents to go first.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Mike Krull. I'm an attorney up in Portland with the law firm of Cooney & Krull. We're general counsel to the Oregon Medical Association. The association supports this bill. I want to give a little different perspective of this bill in the sense of some historical issues. The 31600, ORS 31600, is Oregon's comparative negligence bill, which was passed, I believe, into law in 1977. Prior to that, Oregon followed contributory negligence, if you will. And historically, under contributory negligence, any settlement in a case, the court allowed an offset against the judgment against the defendants. It was not necessary to put on a case against the defendants. The settlement was simply an offset. There was no windfall. It was a matter of that's the way the law worked under contributory negligence. When 31600 came into the law, and again, I think it was 1977, that was not the case. You had to compare the negligence of each tortfeasor against that of the plaintiff, if indeed the plaintiff were negligent, or if the plaintiff was not negligent, then it would be compared among the defendants. The problem was is the way the statute was written was that you could only compare the negligence of parties, and it was and or any settling defendant who was, of course, a party. So you could compare all that fault, in the main case, in the case in chief. If there was a non-named defendant, the defendants could either third party in that defendant if they were subject to the court's jurisdiction. And if they were not subject to the court's jurisdiction, then you would have to go and file a separate claim, a claim for contribution or indemnity, whatever the case may be in the other jurisdiction. What this bill does, in effect, and it's procedural more than anything else, is that it says that in the trial of a case, the negligence of all tortfeasors can be compared, including that of the plaintiff. And that's section one of the bill, and a verdict will be rendered based upon that comparison of negligence. There's nothing nefarious about that. It just simply says the negligence of everyone is going to get looked at. And you don't have to be a party in order to have your negligence reviewed by the trier of fact. Presumably it's the burden of the defense to put on the fact that a non-named party was negligent, and that's the way it works now. That's essentially what section one of this bill does. Section two of the bill, and I may have my sections wrong, but the second part of the bill, essentially says, and as the law works now, if you have a settlement in a case, and the settling party was previously a named defendant, what you have to do as the remaining defendant is put on a case of, quote, negligence against your fellow defendant in order to take advantage of the settlement. And when I say advantage of the settlement never comes up to the jury. It's simply you're required to show the negligence of the settling defendant for purposes of comparison. What this bill basically does is says, look, it gives the defendant a choice. You can either put on a case of negligence, put on proof, and square off against the former defendant with whom you were cooperating, or you can elect not to put on that case, but you will have the benefit of the settlement. The settlement will be deducted from any judgment. That's what this bill does. And it's really that simple.
If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer.
I think we'll take the questions at the end so I can get the full benefit of the panel's testimony. Mr. Sim?
Yes. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bill Syme. I'm an attorney in private practice in Oregon. I'm here as a board member for the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel. Our group represents individuals and companies in defense of civil litigation. And many of our members represent physicians and hospitals in the defense of medical malpractice claims. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2893. Yeah, this is an important bill. And it creates a way to address a significant problem in the current joint and several liability law. I need to take you back to about 1995 and the status of the law then, and the situation where you have multiple defendants in a case. At that point, the liability of the defendants was joint and several. And one defendant could be liable for the entire judgment even though they were only responsible for a small percentage of the injury. And if for some reason one of the defendants settled before trial, that was never mentioned during the trial. But at the end of the case, after the plaintiff had proved all of her damages and gotten an award, the amount of the settlement was used in an offset against the award. That was important because it prevented double recovery to the plaintiff. In other words, the plaintiff was able to plead and prove their entire case and all their damages, and if a defendant had settled, then there was a reduction afterwards. In 1995, the joint several liability laws were changed in a significant way, and with a broad brush, each defendant was now only responsible for their own percentage of fault. If one of the defendants settled, then the defendant who remained could then plead and prove the fault of that defendant. They had the burden of proving that, which means the burden of calling their own experts and proving the case. And that way, the jury could then allocate responsibility between the parties who were at fault. The remaining defendant would be responsible only for their own percentage of fault of the judgment. The jury would award the entire amount of the damages, but the defendant would only be responsible for their percentage of the fault. And, significantly, there was no reduction after judgment for the amount of the settlement. And that was
seem to be fair because there's already a reduction for the percentage of fault to the settling defendant. That law was, in 1995, was thought to promote global settlements, as a means to promote global settlements. And for most cases, it works fine. But in some cases, and in particular medical malpractice cases where there are multiple defendants, there is a significant problem in the operation of the law that was not anticipated when it was adopted in 1995 that can often result in a double recovery of damages to the plaintiff. And it occurs in this situation. You have a medical malpractice claim against both a physician and a hospital. And the claim is that the physician was negligent. The claim against the hospital was that the hospital was negligent in either granting staff privileges to the physician or in not supervising the physician's care. Shortly before trial, that case settles for, say, $1 million against the physician. And incidentally, this scenario is based upon an actual Oregon case. But the plaintiff refuses to settle against the hospital, and that case goes to trial. The jury then awards $1 million against the hospital. They are never told about the settlement. They're never told about the physician's involvement in the case. And they award 100% of what the damages are in that case. There is no offset for the settlement in that case. And so there has been a double recovery. There's been a recovery of $1 million from the physician first before the trial from the settlement. There's recovery of $1 million from the jury verdict where the plaintiff has been awarded 100% of the damages. Now, the only way for the hospital to avoid that situation is if the hospital then undertakes the burden of proving the physician's negligence at trial. And there are numerous practical difficulties with doing that, particularly when you have a settlement that's on the eve of trial or during a trial, because in order to establish that case, you have to call your own medical experts. And it simply is it creates a significant problem, and from my experience, it does not happen where you have a hospital actively trying to prove the negligence of a physician that's on their staff. It just tactically and practically is not something that happens. So what this bill does, and it's important, in that it gives the remaining defendant an election. They can either undertake that burden of establishing the negligence of the remaining defendant and thereby reducing their own percentage of fault, or allow the option to take a credit after judgment for the amount of settlement. And this is an important piece of legislation, and it does prevent this scenario of double recovery that just provided to you. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I think you'll take the last participant, Mr. Neuberger.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. My name is Robert Niederberger. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland. I submitted not really written testimony, but some documents, and I don't mean for you to trouble yourself to read these. These are historical documents, and I just want to mention them briefly. The first one, what they are, the first one's an article I wrote in 1999 about the 1995 amendments. The second installment is an article that Tom Tung, who's Mr. Syme's predecessor, who along with me was asked by then-Chair Neil Bryant to draft the 1995 amendments. And the third document is a memorandum I wrote to Chair Bryant back in 1995 after the committee, his Senate Judiciary Committee, had adopted, in essence, what we now have as the comparative fault and contribution amendments of 1995. I offer these not for your careful reading today because they are very dense, and if your eyes haven't already glazed over listening to the technicalities of this law, these articles are guaranteed to do that. I just want you to know that this is the tip of the iceberg. These issues that are before you were very carefully considered in 1995. Every issue that you heard before you, every criticism, there was no broad brush. These were carefully worked out in Mr. Tung's office as the representative of OADC, and he, after Mr. Tung and I were sworn in by then Chair Bryant to write a fix to what was going on with joint and several liability. To create in what is in essence now in Oregon, several liability. And the main thing I want to point out is, yes, that is my picture. I've been coming down here now for 10 years. I've lost track of how many hearings I've been in on joint and several as these issues come up. And I just wanted you to know how much you can tell how much I have aged on this subject. Every one of these concerns that's been raised has been issued. I want to take just a few minutes to talk about. First of all, everybody shares the concerns of doctors in Oregon and out of the country of what's going on with medical malpractice premiums. It's an outrage, and it's a scandal what's happened to doctors' medical malpractice premiums. But it's false and unfair to blame those premium increases on the patients, on the people who've been injured. And there is nothing in this bill that will reduce medical malpractice premiums in the state of Oregon, that will increase the availability of medical care, or will reduce the rate of medical errors that injure patients in Oregon. This is a complicated area of the law. What is joint liability? Well, in the area of torts, it's become the holy grail. People who support tort reform, we got to abolish joint liability. But they don't really understand it or what that means, the ramifications. Joint liability is a part of the law where you have more than one person who's responsible for an obligation. On a note, when somebody sells goods or services, the people who it's sold to are jointly liable, like in a partnership. And if two or more people cause an injury, whether it's a car accident or some other catastrophe, then they're jointly liable. And the law of joint and several liability then and contribution then resolves after the injured person has been paid and compensated, not doubly, once. Who then bears that? That's why we have a law of contribution. That's what by common law, that's how the defendants or the wrongdoers or the debtors, people owed the money, worked out among them how they should allocate what had been paid to the person who was owed the money. That was the law before the Revolutionary War. That was the law at the time the Constitution of the United States was adopted. That's what the framers of the Constitution said when they adopted the Seventh Amendment of the Constitution and said that the right to jury trial in all actions of common law shall be preserved. That's what the framers of the Oregon Constitution said when they preserved this, that the right to a jury trial shall remain inviolate. They knew joint liability. This is not some recent harebrained idea. Now, the amendments before you, or the bill before you, would amend the existing law in two ways. First, there's the Carnac Clause, and the second is the heads the defendant wins, tails the injured person loses clause. And let me take them one at a time. The 1995 amendments came around because people were promoting tort reform, including OADC and the OMA, said we wanted several liability, no more joint liability. We only want to be held liable for our percentage. Well, then, what do you do if there's a settlement? And you go to trial and you say you have three defendants and the jury says they're all a third at fault, then under several liability, they all pay a third of the bill. Well, what do you do if there's a settlement? The law says, now you got two of them, they can tell the jury they should allocate however much percent, they can argue it should be more than a third, and they're only going to pay their percentage. And so if the jury still says A and B, you defendants A and B, you pay a third, that's all they pay. They don't pay double, they don't pay more, and the injured person doesn't receive more. Now sometimes, when you settle before trial, you don't know if the jury's going to award more or less against that party, the one you settle with. You just don't know. And so, as I noted in the first article I submitted to you, the one I wrote, I quoted Dean Wade, who's probably the nation's foremost authority on this, and it's in the first full paragraph on the third page. He says that the law we have now may not strongly enough encourage settlements, and we want to encourage settlements, right? That's what courts do. They're set up to resolve disputes, and we like to resolve them out of court. Not that anybody pays more, but that they settle. And what did Dean Wade said? But even though the current law doesn't do enough to encourage settlement, On the whole, I find this solution to be the most desirable of the three, and I recommend it. And that's why we have it. Because there are unintended consequences when you go along with the Carnac Clause. Now, you all remember who Carnac was. That's the late Johnny Carson. He had that skit, you know, he'd wear the turban, and he'd hold the envelope up, and he'd give some harebrained thing, and then he'd read what was in the envelope, and he was always wrong. Oregon has the, and always has, the most stringent pleading requirements of any state in the country. You can't just file a lawsuit and say, I want money from you because you ran a red light. You got to tell them why. What the 95 amendments did was to give defendants, whether they're doctors or trucking companies or drunk drivers, the ability to file, to bring into the mix anybody who they think is legally liable. And they got to follow the same pleading rules. And those are designed, one, to let people know why they've been sued, how much they've been sued, why they've been sued, what they've been sued for, and have real people in real controversies in court. This makes it a game. Under this law, the defendant would play Carnac. They wouldn't have to sue anybody. They wouldn't have to bring them into court. They wouldn't have to show that they were legally liable. They just, at the end of the case, say, Judge, here's our verdict for them. Yeah, my client ran the red light, but we also want you to put on that verdict form the tavern that served him the liquor. We want you to put the city on there because they should have had a stop sign there. We want you to put the power company on there because they should have had a brighter light. And we also want you to put my client's doctor on there because we think he should have given him a different medication and that might have made him confused. And they wouldn't have to prove anything. Under the current law, they got to go out and investigate, line up a case, and prove it, just the way a plaintiff does. And that, in essence, is the 95 Amendment said, if you want the right to sue people, and you want the right of only several liability, then you take the responsibility to bring into court, to hail them in, and make them a part of the mix, but don't do it frivolously, because in Oregon, we don't like frivolous lawsuits, and we also don't like frivolous defenses. Now, that's the Carnac Clause. Now, what's the effect of this? We heard earlier this morning, well, we don't want any unfairness. So when you have the Carnac Clause as the law in Oregon, and the jury says, yeah, we're going to assign some fault to somebody who's not here, who may not even have legal liability, who may have just been a phantom driver. The reason I hit him, Your Honor, was there was a phantom car, and I swerved, and I lost control. They go on the verdict form under the Carnac Clause. Well, what happens then? The verdict gets reduced by those percentages. There's no recovery against them because they're not in court. They don't owe any money legally. We've just cheapened the recovery. So who pays now? Now, the medical community like think, well, that's great because now we don't have to pay as much. Doesn't mean that the person who's on a ventilator who needs 24-hour care costing $100,000 or $200,000 a year for the rest of their life doesn't have those bills. Who's going to pay it? The family? Blue Cross, SAFE, the Oregon Health Plan, welfare, somebody going into bankruptcy. That's a real bill, and a bill comes due. And we shouldn't cheapen it this way with the Carnac Clause. Now, the second clause is the supposed offset. They said they wanted several liability. Just make us pay our share. And that's what the law does. That's what the 95 amendment says, and it's worked perfectly. In 10 years, nobody has paid more than their share. But what they want to say is now, well, no, yeah, we like several liability, except when it's to our benefit to have joint liability. We don't want to take that old offset rule where you just deduct a dollar for dollar, and that way we'll pay less than our percentage share found by a jury. Now, I realize this is all very confusing. Law students don't understand it. Law professors don't understand it. And most lawyers don't understand it. But I want to put this in perspective, and then I'll finish it. Most cases in this state are for under $50,000, and they involve one party suing another party. There's no joint liability. And when you take those few cases that involve two people owing on a debt or three people owing on a debt, most of the time those people all have enough money to pay it. You take a $50,000 car accident case, minimum policy in the state's 25, everybody's got enough money to cover whatever their percentage is. And the same thing's true of even bigger cases. So there's several liability, joint liability. It's all theoretical. It only applies in a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of cases. Not that it doesn't matter, but it does. But this is not a pervasive big issue. And what we have is the medical community saying, we don't want to have to prove that one of our fellow doctors or the hospital where we work at was at fault after somebody settled with them. We don't want to do that. They want to circle the wagons. But if you step outside of the medical cases, and remember, medical cases are, there are only a few of them a year in Oregon. I have a case right now. It's defended by the biggest firm in the state of Oregon that defends doctors and hospitals up in Portland. It's not a medical case. I just represent a woman who was on her way back home to Garibaldi when her husband was driving. It was a really honest, it was a dark and rainy night. And there was a big, long, it was low-boy trailers, and they had a permit that said, trucking company that said they have to have a pilot car because the thing's so long, and the regulations say when you're going to block the road, you got to have that pilot car there. Well, guess what? They didn't bother to have a pilot car. And guess what? Guy pulls up off a dirt road onto the highway. He high centers, doesn't get out, doesn't put any flares. My client's husband runs into the truck, and she ends up in intensive care for a month. $350,000 a medical bill. We filed a lawsuit against a trucking company. Came back like a boomerang. You know what they did? They sued her husband. They didn't bat an eyelash. But if it's a doctor, they don't want the same law to apply. This law is complicated because the subject matter is complicated. It does the best it can. No matter how well you write a law, there's always going to be somebody that comes along and says, you know, I don't get treated as well as I should. But these 95 amendments were very well thought out. There's some issues with the law I'd like to see a change. I lost some issues because of Mark King Street. But I'm not here to cry about them today. But this didn't come about as an unintended, you're not hearing about an unintended consequence. And the real losers in this are going to be patients who are not properly compensated and their families who are going to not be able to pay their medical bills. I want to respond one thing about to my friend Charlie Hinkle. I have a lot of respect for Charlie Hinkle. But he says that there's nothing in this bill that would interfere with a plaintiff's right to receive an award. Well, as I explained to you under the Carnac Clause, that's exactly what would happen. Falk just allocated out to people who aren't even court, who are not going to be required by due process to respond in damages. That clearly is a substantial interference with the right to recover. I apologize for going on so long. It's a real complicated area of the law. You know, I feel like that cartoon character in The New Yorker, the one down in the dungeon has got the smock. It's all kind of, you know, ratty. And I get brought up to talk, bring it here to this nice hearing room every 2 to 4 years to talk about joint and several liability. And joint and several liability, it stays. I stay. Legislators come and go. The issue is always going to be there. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee?
Make sure I understand
one of the crucial changes, and I'm reading basically from the statute, from the bill staff report, but under current law, you can allocate the fault of a person that is named in the case. This makes a change because you can allocate the fault against persons that are not named in the case. Is that one of the fundamental changes that you're asking for? We're reading that correctly.
Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chairman, is the so-called Carnac Clause. And might I add that I think, with all due respect to Mr. Neuberger, the bill says, considered by the trier of fact. Now, I don't know where this notion of after the case is tried, you start adding on defendants or adding on people who are you think should be held liable. Clearly and unequivocally, if in this state, if you allege someone is negligent, you have the burden under our pleading rules to prove those allegations. The bill says, considered by the trier of fact. This isn't Carnac.
Wouldn't it, though, be a good defense strategy for those named defendants to try to shift as much of their responsibility for negligence against the non-appearing parties, because the non-appearing parties can't defend themselves? Doesn't that
tend to be unfair and might represent some lopsided allocation of damages between the named and unnamed defendants.
Well, one could wonder out loud why the party wasn't named. As an example, in the automobile truck accident, why didn't the wife name the husband? Now, possibly there was some immunity under the law because of the marriage, but the fact of the matter is that if the plaintiff decides, or for whatever reason, elects not to name a tortfeasor, why should the defense not be able to plead and prove what the negligence of that non-named party was? Now, if they're not successful, the award will not be reduced.
But if the party was not named that was potentially responsible in negligence, couldn't the defendant file a third-party claim and bring that party in?
Maybe. Maybe. Okay. What if that non-named party is a resident of the state of Idaho, and under the facts of the case, there's no long-arm jurisdiction, no way to bring them into a court in the state of Oregon?
Well, I understand there could be technical difficulties in doing that. I just wanted to establish for the record that you do have a remedy to bring in unnamed parties through the third-party pleading practice.
For the record, not always. You may not. The negligent tortfeasor who's not named may be beyond the jurisdiction of the Oregon court. And you can't third-party in somebody that the court has no jurisdiction over. So, and you could go to another state and file, presumably, after you had to pay their share of the verdict, a claim for either indemnity and or for contribution. But what this would do is cut down on that kind of litigation.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Comment?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. I want to address that last point. It comes as no surprise who is going to be on the verdict form, because that is something that has to be specifically included in the pleadings. So if a defendant is going to allege that someone else should be held at fault and that their fault should be considered, they must specifically plead that in their answer. That puts then the plaintiff on notice that that is an issue that's going to the jury, and the plaintiff then has the ability to bring that party in as a named party if they so to choose to do so. That's only in Section 1 of the bill. Section 2 of the bill has to do with this double recovery, and I can tell you that that is a gap in the current law that the plaintiff's lawyers very much understand and use to their strategic advantage, particularly in these medical cases, and it was not something that was anticipated when the joint several liability laws were enacted in 1995.
Thank you. Further questions, Representative McPherson?
Mr. Chair, I want to follow up on that last question and take the question of Mr. Neuberger. Without this bill, the settlement with one of the joint tortfeasors then is not applied as an offset against their share of comparative negligence. Is that right?
Chair Ackerman, Representative McPherson, the short answer is there is not, under current law, a dollar-for-dollar offset, because that is inconsistent with several liability, which says each wrongdoer, each defendant, pays their percentage. So when you have a settlement, and you start out with three defendants, and the jury says they're each a third at fault, but you've settled with the third one, the remaining defendants pay the percentage applied against them, so the dollar amount determined by the jury. The jury says $1,000, and they're each a third at fault, they each pay $333. So the amount of the settlement doesn't matter. If the plaintiff settled for less than $300, or $333, the plaintiff is short that amount. If the plaintiff settled for $133, the plaintiff is now short $200. If the plaintiff settled with that third defendant for more, then yes, the plaintiff did get more, but nobody knew that at the time. That's the part where Dean Wade said we're not doing enough to encourage settlements. So if the settlement was for less than the amount found by the jury, then the plaintiff comes out short. If the settlement was for more than it turned out that the jury allocated to the settling party, then yes, the plaintiff actually ends up with something more in that hypothetical case. But that's consistent with several liability. If we go along with this proposal, it's the heads they win, tails the plaintiff loses, because they're going to elect the one which benefits them either way. They're just going to wait and see what happens.
Further questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And any further persons wishing to participate in the hearing on the House Bill 2893? Hearing none, I will then close the public hearing on House Bill 2893 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2894. I'm going to have some of the same suspects come back, and I'll just call them proponents first. Again, Mr. Gallagher, Mr. Dorrigan, and Mr. England, Dr. Englander, if you'd like to come forward. Yeah, council will summarize the bill.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. House Bill 2894 allows the trier of fact to deduct collateral benefits from an award of damages made in certain medical malpractice claims, and it specifies exceptions to that, and it also prohibits a payer of collateral benefits from seeking repayment from the plaintiff, defendant, or other certain persons.
Gentlemen, you can start anyway, any order you wish.
Representative Ackerman, Jim Dorrigan, testifying in favor of House Bill 2894. This allows the introduction of evidence of health insurance or disability insurance payments made or that will be made on behalf of the plaintiff, and allows the trier of fact, a judge or a jury, to deduct those collateral benefits before the entry of a judgment. Again, this is a bill that opens up the additional information to the jury. When a case goes to a jury, the part of the damages are medical benefits or disability benefits, and the jury is not made aware that the injured person has had those benefits already paid from another source. So what this does is it eliminates that, or it allows introduction of the fact that these have been paid from a collateral source. Then it says that the trier of fact may deduct those benefits. If they do deduct those benefits, then it prohibits the insurance company that paid those benefits from coming back against the judgment. What this does mechanically for us in medical malpractice cases, it makes cases more simple in that there's not a lien against any settlement or judgment that's out there, and I think it will facilitate settlement of cases and reduce the cost of settlement of cases, and in that way I think it will benefit the insurance companies dealing with the cases. It'll benefit the defendant doctors in the cases. So we are in favor of this bill.
Thank you. Next.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Charles Hinkle. I'm a lawyer in Portland. I'm testifying in favor of 2894 solely on the constitutional issue. The constitutional right to a remedy under the Oregon Constitution is a right to have full compensation for one's injuries. It is not a right to make a profit. It's not a right to gain more money than fully compensates for your injuries. And the right to a jury trial is the right to have a jury decide what that amount of money is. If 2894 becomes law, an injured plaintiff will still get that full amount of money that a jury has determined, but the injured party will still have the full remedy guaranteed under the remedy clause. Full compensation and a full jury determination of that compensation. So in my opinion, there is no constitutional objection to House Bill 2894.
Thank you, Mr. Hinkle. Doctor?
Thank you. Ray Englander, again, Chairman Ackerman and members of the committee. I'm the simple neurologist from down the road. I've been listening to all of this complicated legal testimony. And, you know, I mean, I just, two things. One, I look at this at my age, increasingly from the standpoint of a patient, not from that standpoint of a physician, although I am both at the current time, and probably will become gradually more of a patient and less of a doctor as time goes by. And from that standpoint, I want to do anything I can to make sure we have the best doctors and the best hospitals in Oregon if I decide to retire here. I don't want to be thinking that I'm going to get second-rate care from the cast-off doctors that choose to locate here rather than the best. And I also look at this just, again, as just a sort of an ordinary citizen. Why shouldn't the jury have all this information? Same with the last bill. We talked about all these legal things, but what's wrong with the jury knowing everything? Why shouldn't the jury know
other money that's been paid, whether by insurance companies or whether by other physician defendants or hospital defendants or one thing or another, doesn't, just from a common sense standpoint, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me that we're setting the rules up so that the jury, who's supposed to decide all these things, does it in a partial vacuum. If I see a patient, I need to know everything. I need their past medical history. I need all the pertinent information. If the patient doesn't share some of that information with me, I'm going to have a hard time doing the right thing for that patient. And sometimes patients don't share everything, and we do run into that problem, of course. And I think the same is true here. Why shouldn't they have all the information? I think this is part of that. And I think the public has sort of figured that out. I mean, if we look at, just to go off on a slight tangent, the outcome of Measure 35 in the election this past November compared to a different but similar in some ways cap on non-economic measure about 4 years earlier, there was a huge swing in the electorate. They are seeing the medical problems, and that's what we need to help with. We need the access to care. We need the access to good care, and that's why I came today. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of the committee? Seeing none, appreciate your testimony.
Actually, Mr. Chair, if I could. I'm assuming that, Mr. Dorgan, the probably health insurance expenses for the future for caring for the consequences of whatever the alleged injury is, that's probably the principal source of offset that would occur?
It wouldn't be on the future benefits because there's no guarantee of future health care. It's just a collateral source is what has been paid already.
I see. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. I'll call up the next panel, Mike Crew, Richard Lane, and John Powell. And as they're coming forward, is there anyone I have omitted that has signed up? And this will be our last panel on this bill.
Thank you, Senator.
Would
like to sign up on the bill on this one.
Yes.
Would like to
say something. Why don't you sign up on the list and I have somebody help you and then we'll call you. Okay, Mr. Crew, you may go first.
All right. For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Mike Crew. I'm an attorney at Portland, represent the Oregon Medical Association. Very briefly, echoing what the former witnesses said, this only covers payments that have already been made. It doesn't cover future payments. But more importantly, I might point out that under current Oregon law, this body, the legislature, formally said under ORS 31.580, that in fact a jury can consider collateral sources of payment. But unfortunately, it's discretionary, and in most cases, the judge doesn't permit that kind of evidence to come in because, as a general proposition, the plaintiff is required to repay it, and therefore the court won't allow the testimony. That's my experience. That's the practice, I believe. This bill simply changes
for a moment. Did you say that the deduction is only for bills that have been paid and not with those which would be paid?
I believe that's the way the bill reads.
I read Section 2 differently, and I want to get this out right away. On line 14, trier of fact deducts benefits that were paid or that will be paid. It seems to seem somewhat different from I understood your testimony to believe, so I want to get that straight first.
And I stand corrected. I followed what the former testimony was it would also constitute collateral source would include future payments.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but
fine, and that's
I had a conflict with what you were saying. Okay, thank you.
But with that said, what this bill essentially does is say that the source of the collateral benefit cannot seek repayment either from the injured party and or from the defendants, and that's the change in the law, and the OMA supports that concept.
Thank you. Mr. Lane?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Richard Lane. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association to oppose 2894. What 2894 does is significantly amend Oregon's collateral source rule to the prejudice of one class of injured persons, and it's going to promote lengthier litigation, and it's going to be a lot more costly and expensive and prejudicial for people who have already been harmed through the result of medical malpractice. Historically in this state, Oregon has observed a very strict exclusionary rule regarding evidence of collateral source because of its potential misuse and to avoid unnecessary complex secondary issues which tend to unduly prolong the trial of cases. I won't burden you with the cites from Oregon cases. As far as existing law is concerned today, I would respectfully correct my colleague, Mr. Crewe. Collateral source benefits are never, under any circumstance, and not by anybody's discretion, permitted to be considered by a jury. Oregon has struck a balance with existing ORS 31.580 that states in subsection 2, evidence of a collateral source benefit described in subsection 1 and the cost of obtaining it is not admissible at trial, but shall be received by the court by affidavit submitted after the verdict by any party to the action. Basically, you keep the evidence away from the jury. The jury finds out about both the past medical expenses incurred and the future medical expenses that will be incurred. It returns a verdict, if it's appropriate, to the plaintiff. And if there is some sort of collateral source benefit, and there is an argument that there's some sort of double recovery that needs to be prevented, then the court, on an appropriate affidavit and a motion prior to the time that any judgment is entered and any money is paid, takes care of any collateral source issues. Every Oregon insurance policy, healthcare policy that I am familiar with, includes a provision inside the contract that says, we will pay you these medical benefits that you incur now or will incur in the future, but if there's a third party responsible for any of the liability for causing that harm to which these benefits have paid, you, person we're paying, have an obligation to pay it back to us. It's called subrogation, a right to reimbursement, a lien on any type of recovery. And that's existing law, and it works well. Blue Cross or another healthcare provider will provide benefits to you to cover your loss immediately. If there's a third party found to be responsible for that at some point in time, the money passes through the injured party and returned to the insurance carrier. Everybody is made whole. There is no double recovery. Often nowadays, in addition to any contract provision like that, there's something called a trust agreement that's executed by various healthcare providers. In that case, what they say is, you injured person, you need medical care and coverage now, you need your bills paid, here, sign this. And in order to get those benefits, you're obligated to pay that, sign that trust agreement. The carrier then advances the amount of medical expenses that were caused by the third party, and the trust agreement says, upon receipt of any of that money, you'll pay it back to us. It eliminates any double recovery. Everybody is made whole. The tortfeasor is held accountable. Many of these insurance policies are covered by something called ERISA. We've all heard a lot about it. It's federal laws. Rights of reimbursement are actually prescribed. There's a lot of case law out there regarding the third-party payments. So you're also opening up a can of worms that may conflict directly with federal law on the subject of employer-paid health care benefits. Lastly, I would point out that if for any reason such a bill was enacted and found to be improper, that it denied the insurance carrier the right to recovery, you're talking about a double penalty. The money's been taken away from the injured party. He or she has not been made whole, according to the jury, because the insurance company paid those bills. But if the clause in this bill says that no insurance company can't be denied its right to recover bills it legally paid, then you're talking about a double penalty. The jury never awards the damages, and any damages that are awarded are paid back to an insurance carrier who fronted the bills. The entire bill, as drafted, is a poor policy. It's going to be prejudicial to people who have already suffered some loss or harm, and it has the opportunity to be a double penalty, and it's unnecessary under existing Oregon law, given the 31.580 sub 2.
Thank you, Mr. Lane. Mr. Powell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. We do appear in opposition to House Bill 2894 for many of the same reasons that Mr. Lane just articulated. First of all, just in the body of tort law, the wrongdoer is supposed to pay. Under the provisions of this bill, it is likely that an employer and the employees of an employer would subsidize that payment if the wrongdoer, in fact, is allowed to have the health insurance pay for the injuries caused by a third party. Take a very simple case, a diseased kidney. The physician determines that the kidney should be removed. A surgeon removes the wrong kidney. In that case, the health insurance would pay for the surgeon's bill, the hospital bill, and under the provisions of this act, that provision would not be reimbursed to the health insurance carrier. Thus, in group insurance, that loss would count against the experience rating of that particular employer, and thus the premiums would reflect that. So we object on just basic fairness terms. Secondly, if you look at line 8, the bill appears to exempt life insurance. However, it's very clear that it's not exempt group life insurance that would be paid by the employer. The only life insurance that is exempt from recovery under this act would be where the person paid the premiums themselves, or the family. The person's family had paid the premiums. Thus, group life insurance through an employer would be deducted as well. For those reasons, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, would respectfully urge a no vote on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Powell. Are there questions from the committee to this panel? Seeing none, gentlemen, you're excused. I thank you for your participation this morning. Our last witness is Jane Myers. Would you like to come forward, please? She have testimony?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jane Myers representing the Oregon Dental Association, in support of the bill. The reason I'm here is we would like to work on an amendment to include dentists in the bill. Many dentists, particularly the pediatric dentists and the oral maxillofacial surgeon dentists, frequently work in hospital settings where there are other practitioners involved, like anesthesiologists and the hospital itself. So this is our request to make it a fair bill. Are there any questions?
Okay, if that concludes your testimony, yes. I'll ask if there are any questions from the committee. Are there any of Ms. Myers? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony, and you're excused. Any further witnesses on House Bill 2895? Okay, seeing none, I will then close the public hearing on House Bill 2895.
Mr. Chair,
I'm sorry, 2894. Note that correction. And I will open a work session, public hearing on House Bill 2895. And once again, I'll go through the list in the order presented. Asking Mr. Gallagher Dorrigan and Dr. Englander to come forward, please.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee.
Council, could be some help on summarizing the bill.
House Bill 2895 requires an entry of judgment with installment payments in a medical liability action in which $100,000 or more is awarded for the losses that will be incurred by the plaintiff after the entry of judgment. It provides that a court may require that installment payments be paid through a trust fund, annuity, or other form of security.
Thank you, counsel. Gentlemen?
Mr. Chairman, Jim Dorrigan, CEO of Northwest Physicians Mutual. The periodic payments provision, House Bill 2895, is very similar to one of the key elements of the tort reform in California, which is the micro reform, which has proven to be very successful in California's ability to maintain lower medical malpractice insurance premiums and maintain an active insurance market for medical malpractice. What House Bill 2895 does is, for awards in excess of $100,000, provides that the benefits are structured over the needs of the injured party. What this will do is it will allow a matching of the payments for the award to match up with the needs as they go forward. What we're seeing in some of these cases is that the damage is being blackboarded for the lifelong care of a neurologically damaged individual or a brain damaged child, covering 30 or 40 years of payments. Would be very well suited to have a structure in place that would cover those needs. Also, we feel that this would allow a savings for physicians, doctors, hospitals, and insurance companies, in that an annuity could be purchased to cover the lifelong needs rather than a lump sum cash settlement. And the annuities that we've structured on settlements before, where they're purchased from a top quality insurance company, and then there's a guarantee that's bought from a second insurance company to guarantee the course of the payment. So it's a very secure form of payment, and it is generally accepted and preferred. What we see in settlements is that generally now a lump sum is negotiated at a higher figure, and then that lump sum occasionally is structured out, but for the most part structures are not set up and designed to meet the needs of the damaged person. So we feel it would provide a benefit going forward for both the injured parties and a reduced cost for the insurance companies settling these cases.
Thank you. Next, please.
Chairman Ackerman, members of the committee, Dr. Bill Gallagher, Chairman, Northwest Physicians Mutual Insurance Company. I think this bill is straightforward, makes a lot of common sense. It's pretty simple, doesn't take a lot of testimony. The objection to this bill will be from the trial lawyers, who will say there's not enough money up front to pay their bills. They don't want to take a structured settlement. Very seldom does this happen, that a plaintiff's attorney will take a structured settlement. We would say that's not a problem, because all expenses that have occurred prior to the verdict will be paid up front, and that should be sufficient to pay trial attorney's fees. Second thing I would say is that this bill brings fairness because it prevents a windfall for, say, heirs of an injured patient. There are cases, one I know in the Medford area, where the payout was $10 million and the patient died within 6 months and the family then benefited for $10 million. And that's not what this is all about. So I think this is a common sense bill, and I would ask you to support it. Thank you.
Dr. Englundberg.
Thank you, Chairman Ackerman and members of the committee. I would basically just echo what Dr. Gallagher just said. It seems like common sense to me. I have had in my experience at least two that I can think of, patients who had received awards. I'm not sure if they were medical malpractice or some other sort of award, but they ran through it. They ended up on welfare ultimately, and so they got their care from Medicaid, but they had already been, you know, in essence, given their award to cover that care, but they ran through it with other, they had the money, they ran through it. They managed it poorly. That's their fault, but there are no checks in place to keep that from happening. Then they just bounce back and end up getting the care covered as part of our Medicaid system, which ends up depriving somebody else of Medicaid money. And it doesn't seem like that's the way it ought to work. Again, just sort of a common sense thing. That's my only personal experience in this sort of thing, but it seems clear to me that this makes a lot more sense than what we're doing now. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Are there questions from the committee to the
panel. Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make sure I understand the bill. There was a statement made, I'm not sure if it was Mr. Dorgan or Mr. Gallagher. I think you said, Dr. Gallagher, that there would be sufficient money up front to cover the attorney's fees. And I'm wondering, when I read the bill, I see references to economic damages attributable to losses incurred before the entry of the judgment being immediately due and payable. Is there something else I'm missing in the bill that would create a fund out of which the contingent fee that the plaintiff's counsel had would be paid?
I don't think so. It covers all economic damages up to the time of the verdict to be paid up front.
Given the...
In most cases it's a substantial sum. Now, in our times when it may not be substantial, but most of the times it is.
Right. Follow up if I could, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, you may.
Given the economic reality, for good or ill, that the cost of advocacy is paid in our system out of a contingent fee, I'm wondering if there's something that could be done that would create a portion that would compensate counsel with more than just the economic damages. And those are actually the out-of-pocket costs that have already been incurred by the plaintiff. But take the remaining part of the judgment, that which just tends to dissipate quickly because the plaintiff often isn't in a position to manage their money very carefully or doesn't for whatever reason. Is there some kind of compromise here that could take that portion which is not part of what's necessary to compensate counsel to and spread that over time?
This doesn't specifically address attorney's fees, but what we see in California is the attorney's fees are calculated and taken out of the overall judgment and then the balance used to fund a structure similar to what we see in any case where there's damages, both economic damages and damages, and after the personal injury lawyer takes the 30-40% contingency fee, then the balance is used for the benefit of the injured person.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Further questions? I might have a couple. As I read this, the interest on the judgment is waived. What's the justification for that?
Well, the justification would be that these monies are not owed until the time that they're due. And so if they're being paid periodically, they're not due until they're due sometime in the future, and therefore no interest accrues.
What happens in these cases is that the plaintiff blackboards the injuries and a stream of needed payments going forward, and their economist projects what those payments will be in the future and their specific amounts. So to allow interest in addition to that would be a windfall for the plaintiff.
Thank you. Further questions for the committee? Yes, counsel?
I guess I just had a question, or maybe it's just a remark. This comes up in this bill in 2893 as well. It seems like there's a problem when you look into the future of compensating injured plaintiffs, and this set of witnesses raises a problem when the injured plaintiff dies early and there's that perceived windfall. What about the case when the plaintiff lives longer than expected? Is there a way to deal with that sort of issue, assuming they manage their money in a proper fashion to pay for those medical needs that are needed in the future? Is there a way to account for that type of situation?
Yes, this I believe is a perfect vehicle for that, because what happens in these annuities is that you purchase a structured settlement annuity that has generally a term of 5 years certain and life, because the annuity company looks at the injured person and age rates them and anticipates when they would think that they would die. So in the structures that I've worked with, in the event that someone had a 20-year life expectancy, the annuity had a guaranteed period and life, so they would continue on in the event that somebody lived past the time, past their projected life expectancy. Whereas in a lump sum settlement, the lump sum, if not properly managed and used to pay the benefit forward, can disappear for any reason.
Let me ask a follow-up question on my interest. My interest in the interest waiver portion of the bill. I think your argument was that these future damages aren't all due at this point, therefore we can pay it out in periodic payments without interest. But isn't it true in litigation that future damages are reduced to present value, and that's what is reflected in the verdict, rather than the gross amount of future damages? Or if you don't know the answer, that's fine. I just want to raise this for the other witnesses, too, that might be coming forward that have legal background in this area.
Currently, the statute provides for reduction of future payments for present value. So you've got a battle of economists coming on and talking about what the assumed interest rates would be in the projected reduction going forward.
Okay. Any other comments? Any other questions from the committee? Right. Thank you, gentlemen. I'll call up the next group, Mr. Hinkle, Mr. Crew, and Mr. Milligan.
Chairman Ackerman,
again, let's have the proponents go first. I've been interrupted. Go ahead.
Chairman Ackerman, my name is Charles Hinkle. I'm a lawyer in Portland. I specialize in constitutional law, and I am here to testify about the constitutional aspects of House Bill 2895. I have submitted a memorandum to the committee this morning, and at the bottom of page 2, the next to last paragraph, I cite two cases that I think really go to the heart of the constitutional issues as they apply to this bill, 2895. First, the De Mendoza case, in which the Oregon Supreme Court emphasized that the remedy clause is a guarantee of a remedy for injury done to the injured person, so that the injured person is entitled to recompense, full compensation for the injury done to him or her. But it's not a remedy, it is not a guarantee of a windfall for the injured person's family. It's not intended to create a fund that will be payable on the death of the injured person to someone else. There is no right to recovery, in other words, and there never has been a right to recovery under the remedy clause, for injuries that are not sustained, that have not been incurred. And so what 2895 does is to guarantee that as those damages are incurred, as those payments become due in the future for the hospitalization, for the home care, for whatever it may be, as those damages are incurred, the payments will be made so that the injured person is made whole, does not suffer any financial detriment as he or she sustains those injuries. For the same reason, there is no impairment of the right of a jury trial, because the jury is still making that determination. How much is this person owed? How much are those injuries worth? What will it take to fully compensate that person? But we're going to then guarantee that those payments are made when they're needed. And we guarantee that the money is there when it is needed, because it's going to be paid out in next year and the year after that and in the years to come. And in answer to your question, Mr. Chairman, about the interest, it seems to me that's answered by paragraph, well, on the first page of the bill, lines 19, 20, 21, the dollar amount of each installment shall be based on the gross amount of future damages awarded by the trier of fact, not on the basis of present value of future damages. So interest is already there, because the person is getting that gross amount. That is not going to be reduced to present value as I read the bill. So there is no impairment of the jury trial right to the right to have the jury determine the amount of your damages, and there's no loss of value, because the full value has been calculated by the jury based on the best evidence that it has before it, just as it is now. The best evidence being the testimony from the experts and the actuaries and so forth, who calculate what it's going to cost to support, sustain this person 2 years, 5 years, 10 years down the road. So, in short, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I don't believe there's any constitutional objection to this bill, either under the remedy clause or the right to jury trial clause.
Next.
Go ahead.
Chair Ackerman, my name is Mike Crew. I'm an attorney in Portland, represent the Oregon Medical Association, and the OMA supports this bill. I want to echo what Mr. Hinkle just said. If indeed there were any reduction to present value, then there would be a penalty to the plaintiff under this bill, and this bill specifically says it will not be reduced, and therefore there should be no interest charged on those dollars, because the plaintiff has effectively received the time value of money by the calculation of the damages and the amount of the damages. That said, this bill, of course, won't necessarily fix the crisis that physicians face in terms of the cost of insurance, but what it will do, at least as we understand it, is bring a little bit more predictability to the dollar amounts the insurance companies are going to have to pay out on an annual basis, and it may level to some degree the volatility of premium. That's the reason why the OMA supports this bill, and I think that echoes essentially what Northwest Physicians has said, and that certainly is what we see in the national studies on the subject matter. And I might add, the OMA has an identical bill pending on the Senate side, Senate Bill 1029.
Thank you. May proceed.
Representative Ackerman and committee, my name is Jack Milligan. I'm a resident of Oregon, also a resident of the city of Lake Oswego. I am a structured settlement specialist, 20 years experience. I'm the president of Settlement Professionals Incorporated. And I'm also the founding president of the Society of Settlement Planners, a nationwide organization of individuals like me and associated attorneys and other experts who work with critically injured victims in planning their settlements. I'm appearing today on behalf of myself and the Society of Settlement Planners in opposition to House Bill 2895. We believe this bill is fatally flawed in a multitude of areas. Number one, we think it's bad for injury victims. We think it's potentially bad for the judiciary and potentially bad for all the people of Oregon. This bill attempts to impose a one-size-fits-all solution on critically injured people. Structured settlements, in spite of my background and what I do for a living, are not suitable for all of these claimants. In fact, there are a great percentage of them that have no need for a structured settlement at all. They're best suited by having their funds placed in trust with a bank or other financial institution and managed for their future contingent needs. I think that this potentially can cause a problem for our judiciary, and I'm concerned about that as a private citizen, because it requires additional judicial oversight and adjudication past just the trial where the judgment is entered. As many of us know, our judiciaries are already overtaxed in terms of the amount of cases they have to see and the resources that they have to apply to the trying of those cases. The reason that I think it's potentially bad for all residents of Oregon goes to the fact that this House bill says that damages may be paid in installments. And it says that as a condition, and this is under Section 1, Number 3, a court may, and I underline may, require that the installments be paid through a trust fund, an annuity, or other form of security acceptable to the court. Here's the issue that I think that this raises. This bill does not require that an annuity policy be purchased from one of the top, strongest insurance companies in the country, but it allows and keeps the door open for the defendant or their casualty insurance company or a casualty company or a self-insured such as a hospital to fund these future payments out of their own cash flow, which raises a situation in my mind of injured claimants being dependent upon these companies and these tortfeasors for payments that could stretch 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years into the future. Traditionally, in the structured settlement annuity marketplace, only the biggest, strongest, most gold-plated insurance companies have been allowed or could even compete in this marketplace. Companies such as New York Life, Prudential, Metropolitan, Allstate, the virtual cream de la cream of the U.S. insurance industry. The potential unintended consequence that I can see happening here is plaintiffs and injured parties being forced to take a promise of payments from a tortfeasor who later fails financially and leaves our injury victim with an empty bag. And at that point, as one of the other speakers today said, they would potentially fall on the social welfare system, Social Security, or maybe the Oregon Health Plan, which could be a detriment to all of us as citizens of the state. The also, this bill makes a provision that any judgment entered under this section does not attach as a lien to the real property of the judgment debtor, not unless there's a supplemental judgment, and that supplemental judgment only happens after a three-payment default. I can see in the potential for a situation where one of our judgment debtors has a three-payment default across many different claimants and finds themselves in a position where they're now bankrupt, and there's at that point nothing for our judgment creditors or our injured claimants to claim against except to stand in line with all the other general creditors trying to get some sort of financial justice from what's left of that individual company. The We also think that the provision here in number 8 where any installment payments attributable to future damages shall cease upon the death of the judgment creditor is terribly unfair and bad policy. Many times in these cases, our clients are asked to fully, completely, and irrevocably release the defendants and everyone associated with them, including their insurance companies, from every possible action associated with their particular claim and case, including the potential claim for future wrongful death. If the injuries to this claimant were so severe that it actually brought about the early demise, they're being asked to waive the right to recover for future wrongful death damages at the same time they settle the case. This is standard language in these settlement agreements. It's long been thought that any remainder payments in funding vehicles, traditional being the structured settlement annuity that remained after the death of the claimant, went to his estate not as a windfall, but to compensate the beneficiaries for the early and wrongful death of that individual. So under the remedy clause, we think that those remainder amounts are a just compensation, not unjust enrichment. For all of these reasons, I individually and as a representative of the Society of Settlement Planners would encourage the committee to vote no on this 2895.
Thank you very much. Has everybody testified? All right. Then questions? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Milligan, I see the flaws that you have pointed out in the bill, and they do seem pretty dramatic. But there is a concept this bill is trying to, or a problem it's trying to address, which is that there's a tendency for lump sum settlements that are paid to plaintiffs to get dissipated in the early years. At least anecdotally I've heard that. Is there some other solution to that problem that you've encountered in your professional work, something that would require that some proportion of the judgment that's attributable to future damages would be paid out in installments, you know, through an annuity that's purchased from, a solid insurance company, or if it were an insurer paying the judgment on demonstration they had sufficient reserves?
The solution to that, Representative, I think, is education. In my experience, in nearly 20 years working in this area, working with both defendants and plaintiffs, but for the last 10 years, almost entirely for plaintiffs, I think that the anecdotal evidence of plaintiffs wiping out settlements in short order, while true, is the exception. From our records in my office, I think that between myself and the other experts that do what I do and service the community here, both from the defense and plaintiff side, that there's very few of these claimants in these catastrophic personal injury situations that don't end up with a structured settlement annuity, a structured settlement trust, or some other managed trust investment. It's the exception when someone walks out with all of the cash in their pocket and we hear the story 1, 2, or 5 years later that they've gone through all the money. It has happened, but I don't think it's the problem that it's being presented to this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions for the committee? I just have one question directed to Mr. Hinkle. This is on the right to a jury trial issue, and as I understand this bill, the jury would return a verdict, and the court would have the authority to provide a supplemental judgment which would waive interest, release the judgment debtor from a judgment lien, provide for the periodic payment of future damages, installment payments. Isn't this a nullification of the jury verdict? In other words, the jury doesn't rule upon these things that I've just mentioned. It's something that's now vested in the court. Doesn't that nullify a jury verdict?
I don't believe so, Mr. Chairman. The function of the jury is to decide who is liable for my injuries, and if somebody is liable, how much I have been damaged, and to set that amount of damages. There's nothing in here that detracts from those two functions of the jury. The jury never has had any role in enforcing a judgment or in deciding on a bond or any kind of security for to secure the payment of a judgment. What happens after that jury is released, including the entry of a judgment and everything else, all occurs after the jury is released, and it doesn't impair that jury function whatever. My right to have a jury is the right to have the jury decide whether or not Joe injured me, and if so, how much are my injuries, and how much does Joe owe me?
Well, I guess my point is the jury verdict is substantially changed by this bill, and I believe that would be a denial of the jury right to a jury trial.
Oh, I don't believe so.
The verdict and the judgment are not going to match under any circumstances.
I think there would have to be, if this bill becomes law, there would have to be a new form of jury verdict. The jury would be asked to assess one amount of damages to decide how much I have already incurred. What were my hospital bills? What is my pain and suffering now? And that sum is immediately due and payable. The verdict, there'd have to be a special interrogatory or a separate section of the jury verdict form that says, and secondly, here is what we award you for your future damages, because this is what we think your future pain and suffering and your future medical bills are going to be. So yes, the verdict form would be different after this bill, but the jury is still making the full and absolute decision as to what the amount of those damages are.
Okay, thank you. Further questions or comments? Mr. Milligan?
I'd like to add just a couple more points. The Society of Settlement Planners has as its mission statement that we are promoting and preserving the rights of the injured victim to choose not only the experts that will help them with their settlement planning, but also the financial vehicles. So fundamentally, we believe in freedom of choice in these matters. It would appear that I would probably be a proponent of this bill, because if it were passed and if annuities were required, that would be a boon to our business. But we are opposed to it because of the freedom of choice issue. I would like to also add that in these catastrophic cases that I'm involved in, where we have a catastrophically injured infant or an adult, they remain under the further jurisdiction of the court, and the judge decides where their money will be invested and how. And that's why a lot of these cases still get a tremendous amount of protection and review on an ongoing basis as to where the money has gone and what it's doing and how it's being spent.
Thank you. Any questions now from the committee? If not, gentlemen, thank you for your testimony, and I'll call up the last witness on this bill, Jane Myers, again. Ms. Myers, please come forward. For anyone else that would like to testify, now is the time to join the panel on this bill. Ms. Myers, you may proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jane Myers, representing the Oregon Dental Association, and asking what we support the bill and would like an amendment to include the dentists in the practitioners who are covered by the bill, since they also are dealing with hospitals and other physicians in settings where pediatric dentists and oral maxillofacial surgeons are treating them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Myers. Any questions from the committee to the witness? Seeing none, thank you again for participating. I guess there's no further witnesses on House Bill 2895, so I will close the public hearing on that bill and open a public hearing on House Bill 2896. And Dorgan and Dr. Englander to come forward as the first panel, and I'll ask counsel to explain the bill. I think we're just within our time limits, and I appreciate everyone's effort this morning to pick up our time, which we lost by convening 15 minutes late. Gentlemen?
Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2896 requires the submission of a medical liability claim against a physician, a nurse, or a healthcare facility to a pre-litigation hearing panel. It also directs the Board of Medical Examiners to appoint a hearing panel. It specifies procedures applicable to these proceedings.
Chairman Ackerman, I'm Jim Dorgan, CEO of Northwest Physicians Mutual, here to testify in favor of House Bill 2896. Before I go into the details of this bill, just a general comment about the bills today and the situation in the state of Oregon. The bills that we've talked about today are bills that have been enacted in many of our neighboring states. If we look at the entire landscape of the West Coast, Oregon is standing out as one of the few states without tort reform, and that continues to impair our ability to attract and retain quality physicians. House Bill 2896 is a bill that addresses 95% of the cases that we deal with. If you look at the eventual result of malpractice cases once they're filed, 75% are dismissed or closed without any indemnity payment. They go away. About 20-25% are paid, closed before the time of trial. Less than 5% of the cases go to trial. What this bill is designed to do is to get a speedier resolution for the cases that are either going to get dismissed or get settled by providing a simple process to review the facts of the case and to have an independent panel tell the parties involved with the case whether they think there's liability or whether there isn't liability in the case. And then it does not impose any requirement the case gets settled or dismissed. It does not require that the findings of the panel are admitted or they're not admissible to the court. So really it just provides a pre-screen and review to make cases go away more quickly or to settle more quickly. And how we came to this bill is we looked around the country at who had effective pre-litigation screening panels and what we could implement that wouldn't be subject to a constitutional challenge. Maine has a program of pre-litigation screening that is much more complicated, much more detailed in discovery, much more expensive, and also unanimous findings from that panel are admissible at time of trial. We have personal experience in dealing with a pre-litigation screening panel of this form in the state of Idaho. Northwest Physicians Mutual insures about 20% of the physicians in the state of Idaho, and they have this, we modeled 2896 after the pre-litigation process in the state of Idaho. What we find in our cases there is that cases are quickly prepared and screened. In the event that they are found to have merit, they're settled more quickly. If they're found to not have merit, they generally disappear. But it does not impair the ability for someone who disagrees with the panel finding to take it to trial. And in researching this and going through the process, I sat down with the head of the medical board in the state of Idaho that runs the process. They feel that the process has been very effective for them. I also met with the head of the medical society in the state of Idaho. The physicians feel that it is very helpful for them, because one of the biggest issues for physicians is that if they're in the process, you know, a minor defendant involved in a case, they have that stress or that dagger hanging over their head for a year to 3 years as they go through the process. This gets the cases resolved more quickly, gets the physicians back to being productive, and gets the 95% of cases that don't go to trial, it causes them to reach an early resolution. The other element of this that you've got to consider is the costs of medical malpractice insurance. About 30 to 40% of our costs of indemnity and defense, about 30 to 40% of that cost is the cost that we pay to provide legal counsel, get review, go through the process of preparing cases for trial. We feel that that will have a significant impact if we can get cases resolved more quickly or dismissed more quickly, and that's the thrust of this bill. One of the things that you hear, that we've heard, is that none of these will impact the cost of insurance. As a mutual company, if we pay less, if it costs us less to deal with cases, we can charge less to the physicians that we insure. So we feel that this is a bill that makes sense. It's one that's talked about. It seems to be bipartisan in terms of both sides have talked about this, and one of the issues is getting a quick resolution, and we feel that this is a tested pre-litigation screening process in the state of Idaho, and we feel it would be effective for Oregon physicians and hospitals. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Before you begin, I just want to state for the record, we have 7 additional witnesses, and we have to be on the House floor at 11. So I'm going to, after this panel is over, I'll call witnesses that haven't previously testified, and hopefully we can make it within the time limitations. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I think you need to know where we're going if we're running out of time. Thank you. You may proceed.
Chairman Ackerman, members of the committee, I appreciate that very much, and I'll be very, very brief. I think Mr. Dorgan summed it up very nicely. I think this is a bill that makes sense. I think it's a nonpartisan type of bill. In principle, it's agreed upon by everybody. There are details that differ, and that can be worked out in the future. But I would say that it is non-controversial, because in our Measure 35 campaign, the main opponents to it, in the Measure 35, as you know, we wanted to try to stop frivolous lawsuits, and what we heard coming back from the other side, which was primarily personal injury attorneys, was we need to have some type of pre-litigation screening panels, and therefore that's what we are wanting to do, and we'd ask to have you support that. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Engelner?
Thank you, Chairman Ackerman, members of the committee again. This time I'm here more as a doctor on this one. I have been fortunate enough in my 27 years of practice in Oregon not to have a suit against me, but I've certainly had friends who have had, and it's somewhat paralyzing for some of them, especially the sense that they are hanging out there for such a long period of time. They may think they haven't done anything wrong, but they're hearing all these things they don't know. And just to get some sense of where is the case and some rather unbiased sense from a panel of people who represent physicians, lawyers, and general citizens would be helpful, even if they say it should go to trial. Just having that and knowing where they stand would be a great help. The second thing I just want to say briefly is that some may think that by having, as the way this is structured under the Board of Medical Examiners, would be kind of like keeping it within the physician's club. But let me assure you, doctors do not look at the Board of Medical Examiners as their friends. We fear the Board of Medical Examiners. We don't think they're always fair to us. And I think that's a reasonable place to go. They're used to disciplining physicians and dealing with physician discipline issues. And so I think that would be, if we're going to have a pre-litigation screening panel, I think that's a reasonable place to have it reside. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doctor. Questions from the committee? Hearing none, then, you're excused. And thank you again for your participation this morning. I'll next call Scott Gallant, Bruce Bishop, Larry Goldbrook. Let me also ask Tom Gallagher to join this panel, too, if he's... I saw him. There he is. Please come forward, Mr. Gallagher.
Mr. Chairman, I've been designated the first off to testify, Scott Gallant with the Oregon Medical Association. My testimony and a couple of attachments are being handed out to you. The Oregon Medical Association does support the idea of having pre-litigation screening panels. Some of you may remember that a long time ago in December of 2004, an interim committee finalized work on looking at the Oregon malpractice situation. And among the things that the committee, while they did not make conclusions, suggested was that pre-litigation screening panels would be a alternative that the legislature might want to consider. And they said in part in their cover letter that in their view the single most startling fact and the fact which gives the most opportunity for change is the inefficiency of the medical malpractice insurance system. By inefficiency, we refer to the proportion of premium dollars which reach injured persons compared to other types of insurance, such as workers' compensation and automobile insurance. Only 38% of the money paid goes ultimately to claimants. Over 44% goes to legal costs. We, too, have reviewed a variety of states that have pre-litigation screening panels, and we understand that Northwest Physicians Mutual has had a positive experience with the Idaho model. The Medical Association, however, chose to propose in Senate Bill 1029, among other things, what we call the Maine model of pre-litigation screening. And the reasons are really pretty simple. First of all, Maine does not have a limit on non-economic damages, which is similar to the state of Oregon. Secondly, it has a hammer for both defendants and plaintiffs in the sense that the panels do make a determination of whether or not, in their opinion, a case is meritorious or not meritorious, and that is admissible at trial. I understand that my good friend, Mr. Wolbrock, who I get to see every 2 years or during initiative periods, have great concerns about that approach. But we thought that it was more important to be aggressive in regard to pre-litigation screening panels, that the parties would realize that there was real teeth to this process. You have in your handout an analysis from the Maine Medical Association from their program and their view of how it has worked. Our proposal is modeled after it. It is not exactly like it. It would be administered under the Supreme Court or Supreme Court administrator. And I've also provided you another handout which outlines the differences and similarities between our concept of pre-litigation screening panel and Northwest Physicians Mutual. I would point out that on page 4 there is a comment about attorney's fees and limitations thereof. That's in the more general part of the legislation, does not apply to the panel process. I apologize for that error. I'll stop there, Mr. Chairman, and be happy to respond to any questions.
Fine. We'll take the questions at the end. Whoever wishes to testify next.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I have presented written testimony for the subcommittee's consideration. Divert just a little bit. One of the things I learned this morning is that when my colleagues at the bar say, with all due respect, they commonly don't mean it. 37 years ago, I was a first-year law student at Hastings College of the Law, where I learned torts from Dean William Prosser. Some of you may know Mr. Prosser. In first-year torts, we had a guest lecturer one morning, a gentleman named Melvin Belli, a famous San Francisco trial lawyer. And during his remarks, which mostly centered around himself, Mr. Belli referred to himself as the king of torts. When Professor Prosser returned to the classroom, a student asked him what he thought of Mr. Belli's representation, and all Professor Prosser could do was snort. My formal statement is that the Hospital Association supports Hospital 2896. We think that pretrial screening processes are appropriate and will be helpful in reducing litigation and the delay that litigation can produce. I outlined in the testimony a couple of specific points that we are concerned about. First of all, we are concerned with the appropriateness of the Board of Medical Examiners performing that function, and would suggest that the subcommittee look to see if there is a more appropriate agency for administering that responsibility. Second, we would urge the committee to look carefully at the language in terms of what materials and matters are confidential and may be disclosed by whom. I see some inconsistencies in the language the way the measure is drafted. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Goldberg.
Representative Ackerman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here, and of course thank you for your service. Let me first say a couple things in response to what's been said before me.
Would you state your name for the record?
I'm sorry, Lawrence Wolbrock.
Thank you very much.
I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm past president of that organization. I practice law in Portland. I've been a lawyer for 28-plus years. I represent victims of medical malpractice. Mr. Dorgan said that Oregon was one of the few states without tort reform. I don't know where he was in 1987 and 1995, but we have some of the most massive tort reform in this country. If you want to be a tort lawyer and get rich, you don't come to Oregon. Last study I saw showed that our verdicts ranked 48th out of 50 in the United States. Two from the bottom. As to the issue of doctors leaving the state and hard to recruit doctors, public citizen study of this year found that not only was there an increase in doctors in the state from the year 2000 to 2004, but there was an increase in rural areas. As to the issue of filing frivolous lawsuits, there already is mechanisms to weed those out. Rule 17 requires any lawyer files a lawsuit to certify that it's good faith based on good faith belief of the facts as alleged. As far as I know, there has never been a case against a lawyer or a party for filing a frivolous medical malpractice case, yet that mechanism exists in the law, and it has never been used in my experience, and I think I know what's going on in the courts regarding that subject. If somebody wants to test whether we have the proof, All they have to do is file a motion for summary judgment, and we must certify that we have experts ready, willing, and able to testify on the issues presented. Numerous times we have made demands for settlement in cases before filing cases, and they go nowhere. The cases don't settle until they're 3 or 4 days before trial, if they do often. I would very carefully analyze the data that the insurance company tells you when it says 75% of the claims made or demands for payment are closed without payment. Because if you look carefully, which I have done, at the BME reports of claims made, these are often letters, not filed claims, but letters to the doctor from a disgruntled patient saying, you mistreated me and you owe me compensation. The carriers report those to our Board of Medical Examiners and Department of Insurance and Finance as demands for payment, and then come and tell you that 75% of them are closed without payment. Many of those are not lawsuits, and I would invite you to carefully analyze that data. Finally, make no mistake about it. This is not a bipartisan-supported issue. The lawyers and the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association and the lawyers that deal in this area have never supported this idea of pre-screening panel. And let me tell you why. Let's talk specifically about this bill, if I might. But first of all, let's talk about the problem. According to this study, to Eras Human, which was published by the Institute of Medicine, which is part of the National Academy of Medicine, which is part of the National Institute of Health. This is a study by doctors for doctors, not with lawyers' input, from the year 2000. Said, as you've probably heard, we have 98,000 to 44,000 people a year that die in this country as a consequence of medical errors. That compares to 43,000 from auto accidents, 42,000 from breast cancer in women, and 16,000 from AIDS. On the low end, the numbers attributable is the eighth leading cause of death in this country, medical malpractice. It amounts to $17 billion to $29 billion costs to this society, of which half of those costs go right back to the medical system. What is House Bill 2896 designed to do? Well, first of all, because the bill violates fundamental fairness and due process considerations, it's questionable whether it will do anything. If you look at Section 5, Subsection 2 of this bill, it only allows the party to be present when giving testimony and the party's lawyer to be present when arguing the case. This is not 20th century enlightened, civilized judicial process. This is a kangaroo court. This is a star chamber. It doesn't allow cross-examination. It doesn't allow rebuttal. It allows no discovery. No discovery. And it's not open to the public. And for Mr. Hinkle to come up here and say that it doesn't violate the remedies clause, what about the due process clause? What it does provide is a substantial, costly hurdle for anyone who wants to come to court and prove their damages because of the negligence of a healthcare provider. And because it has no fundamental fairness and guarantees of due process, and look at Section 5, the conduct of this hearing. It doesn't even prescribe what should happen at this hearing. And because it prevents the party from being present, because it's not open to the public, as stated in a later section, it's going to have absolutely no faith and credibility in the public, and nobody who's going to present a case to this tribunal is going to have any confidence in anything that they've done, except the doctors and their insurers, who now realize it puts another substantial hurdle to them filing the case. How is this three-person tribunal to be chosen and constituted? Is it going to be a lawyer that is a former defense lawyer for healthcare providers, such as Mr. Bishop, who comes in and disparages personally lawyers by saying that Gene Prosser snorted at Melvin Belli? Is he going to get appointed because he likes to make ad hominem attacks against people like me? Or is it going to be me? And who's the doctor going to be appointed? Is it going to be Dr. Gallagher or Dr. Englander? Who's going to be appointed to that board? And then the layperson, where are they going to come from? And they're going to have Dr. Gallagher and Mr. Bishop leaning on them to tell them this is no case? And then it's going to go away, and somebody's supposed to have confidence in that procedure? One of the things about our jury system is that it's 12 people chosen at random who are not politicized and manipulated by the political process that has its good and bad points. But if it insinuates itself into the Board of Medical Examiners to allow the appointment of this tribunal, where's the public confidence in that procedure? Why isn't the evaluation process of people like myself who have been doing this for 28 years and Mr. Dorgan's phalanx of claims adjusters good enough to evaluate these cases? Why do you have to put it up to a system that amounts to a star chamber? What is it going to accomplish except its real intended agenda, which is to put another hurdle in place of in front of injured people who want to present their case to 12 impartial citizens? This was introduced, if you look at the sponsors of this bill, by the entire Board of Directors of Physicians Northwest. That's who's sponsoring this bill. It asks that the damages be presented, both economic and non-economic, yet it prohibits the board or this tribunal from making any determination of damages. What's the point of that? There's no discovery allowed, and so the fundamental question, for example, doctor, what did it mean when you wrote, I was out of the room during the delivery of the baby for 15 minutes, is not even going to be answered. You can't even get the policies and procedure from Mr. Bischoff's clients, the hospital, to find out if the hospital violated its own policy and procedure because you're not allowed any discovery. You know, the procedures that we have in court are embodied, as the lawyers on this panel know, on the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure and the Oregon Rules of Evidence, which are specifically excluded under this statute. But what these rules are intended to do is to provide some basic fairness to the conduct of the fact finder. Yet you're going to have fact finders here that are not going to have any sort of guidelines under the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure or the Oregon Rules of Evidence. Now, for Mr. Hinkle and his submissions to you to say, well, this is no more of a burden than a mandatory settlement conference, let me remind you first of a couple things. Under ORS 31.250, we already have mandatory settlement conferences in medical malpractice cases statewide within 270 days of filing. That's required in the statute already. It was passed last session. To say that this is like a mediation or a mandatory settlement conference ignores the fact that this is a fact-finding body without any guarantees of due process. It's not a mediation. A mediation is not a fact-finding body. It's an effort to settle a case. And there's absolutely, I mean, it's almost shameful, the lack of due process guarantees that are found in this bill.
We're going to have to have you summarize right now, because you're going to lose everyone with the floor session starting at 11. We have a little bit of a fudge factor at 11, but not much.
Thank you, Chairman. I'll just summarize by this. Finally, there's massive statute of limitations problems, because if you sue a health care provider but also a medical device manufacturer, a pharmaceutical company that's entwined in this case, you've got one statute of limitations running for them. You've got to go through this procedure before you can file this case against these healthcare providers, and you end up basically with two separate lawsuits. Lastly, let me tell you this. If you saw yesterday's press, you noticed that the property and casualty insurers made record profits last year, $39 billion. They said that was largely attributable to good investment income results, despite four major hurricanes, all the rest of it. What is this designed to do? It's not going to weed out frivolous lawsuits. Nobody's going to have any confidence in it. And what the proponents of this bill should do, and respectfully what this committee should do, is find a way to reduce the rate of medical error in this state and this country, and not provide impediments and less access to our judicial system that those unfortunate victims have sustained as a consequence of medical errors. This won't get rid of frivolous cases. There is no frivolous cases, hardly to speak of, in the system. These cases are too expensive to pursue for anyone to file a frivolous lawsuit. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have you summarized. Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Gallagher?
I'm Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Newspaper Publishers. Very quickly, I think we prefer the bill by the Medical Association and are quite uncomfortable with the public records issues in this bill, the oaths of secrecy in this bill, and the state agency, the Board of Medical Examiners, performing these services. I think we would look much more favorably on the other approach. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Of this panel by members of the committee. Okay, hearing none, we'll excuse you, and I'll go as far as I can with the remaining witnesses I have. You folks are excused. Mr. Hinkle, there's a Kathleen, there's a delay. I'm trying to read the... Thank you. Dale, you want to come forward? And Jane Myers. This exhausts the witness list. I hope we can get done before... We're called into the House floor, and I apologize, but I know we started late, and that was our responsibility. We just had members who were testifying in other proceedings. So we may proceed, and we'll stay here as long as we can until we're called in.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Charles Hinkle. I'm a lawyer practicing constitutional law in Portland, and I've been asked to express an opinion about the constitutionality of 2896. I have not addressed that previously this morning, and I have made no comments about the due process issues that Mr. Wolbach raised. Earlier this morning, you heard Mr. Neuberger quote Dean Wade twice, saying that we are not doing enough to encourage settlement. The purpose of 2896 is to help facilitate settlement, and anything that helps facilitate settlement ought to be welcomed by all sides, it seems to me. There are no due process concerns in this proceeding because this proceeding is purely advisory. It has no enforcement mechanism. It is a way for both sides in a medical dispute to present their best case to a neutral body and get some objective determination as to whether or not as to whether or not this is a viable claim or not. The proceedings are in secret because it is like a mediation where people can let their hair down, give their best case, and it's not a public trial. It shouldn't be a public trial. There is no compromise of the Oregon Public Records Law or of the open courts provision, certainly no compromise of the remedy clause, because a plaintiff with a claim can ignore it altogether. The clause there on page, I quoted in my testimony, but it's on page 3, line 28. A party to a proceeding before a hearing panel is not bound by, affected, or prejudiced by a report of a hearing panel, and it is not admissible in evidence. So if this process doesn't work and parties want to go ahead and litigate to beat the band, they go ahead and litigate to beat the band. There is absolutely no impediment to a court proceeding. I think Mr. Wolbrock was reading the wrong bill. There is nothing in this that prevents a plaintiff from having his or her full day in court. So there is no compromise to the remedies clause, certainly no compromise to the jury trial guarantee, and no violation of the due process clause.
Thank you, Mr. Hinkle. Ms. DeLay?
Good morning, Chair Ackerman.
I don't read signatures very well, but I do read print okay. It's Kathleen Haley.
Good morning, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. I'm Kathleen Haley. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Medical Examiners. As you're aware, the Board has jurisdiction over the practice of medicine in the state, and the Board favors the passage of this bill because the Board wants to be part of a solution to the medical malpractice liability crisis, and also because the model seems to have worked in the state of Idaho. Relative to the number of physicians increasing in the state, those public citizens' numbers are flawed because they represent the number of licenses issued, but they do not speak to the nature of the practice or the number of hours that a physician actually does put into the practice of medicine. Each day on the websites and in literature that cross my desk, I'm seeing about the problems in Oregon, and these are national publications that are saying that Oregon is not a favorable place to practice medicine. In November, there was a close vote on Measure 35, which said that Oregonians are interested in attracting new physicians and retaining the good ones that we have in this state. The Idaho Board reports that through this pre-litigation screening panel, they've been able to diminish the number of claims and weed out those that are not meritorious in advance of going to court and spending that time and money. So where meritless claims can be eliminated or reduced, the board is interested in a solution, whether it be at the Board of Medical Examiners or elsewhere. We have a record of low fees and of being able to handle administrative tasks like this. Thank you and appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you very much. Ms. Myers?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jane Myers, Oregon Dental Association, and in support of the bill, we would like an opportunity to work on an amendment to add the dentists to the practitioners covered in the bill and to suggest that the dentist replace a dentist with light credentials replace the physician on the panel. And that's the conclusion of my testimony.
Fine, thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Hearing none, once again, we appreciate your participation this morning, and thank you. Any other persons wishing to testify on House Bill 2896? Hearing none, I will then close the public hearing on House Bill 2896. For the business of the committee, hearing none, we're adjourned.